Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a podcast of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you wouldn't otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where, as always, we offer you a very exciting opportunity. And please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today, I am pleased to welcome a really good friend and special guest as our guest in relation to this really great book that I'm holding in my hand entitled Christian Zionism 101, 10 Reasons Christians Should Support Israel and the Jewish People. The author is my friend Al McCarn, who Al has a great background, and I want to read some of it, but I think more than reading, just to talk about him, because what I've grown to know about him over the last couple of years is we're talking about somebody which is actually more important than reading the actual bio, who's very, very thoughtful, who's very studious, and this book is a product of that. Al grew up, I'm reading from the book itself. Al grew up in an evangelical environment of a Southern Baptist church, a Presbyterian Christian school, and curiosity about the Pentecostal aspects of the faith. What he learned in his formative years was that the doctrinal differences of these different streams of Christianity were actually just different perspectives on the same scriptural truth, and therefore should not be a cause of division among those people who profess to be disciples of Jesus, but in fact, something that bring together common ground. Now you can tell I'm ad-libbing. Al's worldview, biblical worldview, was refined in his academic endeavors, which always impressed me. And Al, one thing particularly about your undergraduate degree in Russian and German from Florida State University, a master's in international relations from the University of Southern California, and history from University of Alabama, Birmingham, and half a PhD, which I respect. It's better half full than half empty, in history from the University of Arizona. Al's studies and experiences with Western encounters of Islam also mirror some of his experiences in the military, where he served for 30 years as a career. His first tour of duty being in Germany, during which 30 Hezbollah murdered 220 Marines and 18 sailors on an attack on the U.S. barracks in Beirut. This goes on, and ultimately, and I probably will say it a few times, this book, Christian Zionism 101, is something I want you to get, and you'll read more about Al. He and his wife, Charlene, live in South Carolina, where they are active members of Founded in Truth Fellowship. Al, you know what? One more thing that's also very important. In 2019, at the encouragement of another mutual friend, Bob Odell, he became part of the prayer and planning team for what was then called Nations Night of Av and is now called 10 from the Nations, a ministry dedicated to educating Christians about Christian history with the Jewish people and healing the breach between us. That's led to other connections, and Al is also a member of the advisory board of RootSource and an advocate for Zionism and many other things. This is a great book, Al, and I was so grateful that when we were sitting together at, I think this is when it happened, right, at the book event I did for our book in November, back in December in Charlotte, you said, I'm finishing my book and wanted me to get a copy of it. You sent me a copy. And it's one of those books, it's not only that you don't want to put down, it's very easy not to. It's very easy just to keep going because it's so well done And one of the things that I also need to emphasize here, and I know I'm rambling a bit in the intro, very well documented. I mean, there are a lot of footnotes here. This is not the world according to Al. This is the world according to Al, but with lots and lots and lots of backup. So thank you for sending me this book. Thank you for giving me the privilege of reading it. And thank you for joining us today on Inspiration from Zion, where we're going to unpack it and encourage people to get your book.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. It is a pleasure to be here. And it was also one of the highlights of 2024 when in December I was able to meet you in person in Charlotte.
Right. It's funny that that was the first time that we met in person, because it doesn't feel like that is a proper part of the formula. We should have known each other a long time. We do from other events, but a lot of those events have been virtual.
Yeah. And I put that down to, we move in the same circles.
Yes.
And it, particularly in the process of writing this book, I was able to take stock and realize the same names on both the Jewish side and the Christian side keep coming up.
Mm.
It's like there is a dedicated, to use an army term, cadre of people that Hashem has called from both sides to pioneer this effort and make firm connections, broaden the bridge, and invite others along. So we were bound to meet inevitably.
And I, by the way, and I was grateful and surprised in reading in the intro that you mentioned me. That was really lovely to be among that cadre of people that make a difference, and with some other really, really great people. By the way, full disclosure, I'm introduced here as a rabbi. I am not. So for the second, third, and fourth editions, we'll change that. But for right now, for the record. But anyway, Al, let's jump into the book. 10 Reasons, Christian Zionism 101, 10 Reasons Why Christians Should Support Israel and the Jewish People. What was the impetus for this? It's not just something that you sat down at the computer to write, as I do to knock out a 1,000-word article, but you researched it. There's a lot of work that went into this.
Yeah, I would say probably half a lifetime. The spark of inspiration was a text from my good friend and publisher, David Wilbur, who kind of tongue-in-cheek sent a text that last June 2024, and said, when are you going to write the book on Christian Zionism so I could publish it? And a few days later, we sat down at dinner. He came up with the title Christian Zionism 101, 10 Reasons Christians Should Support Israel and the Jewish People. And together we outlined this chapter format of one chapter per reason.
Yes.
Starting with, from the Christian viewpoint, our Messiah is Jewish.
Right.
The one we call Messiah, you know, Jesus Christ, that he's the reason that we are in the faith. And recognizing the fact that he was a Jew, he lived as an Orthodox Jew, and as I relate in that first chapter of the book, one of my friends who is a lifelong pastor, when he realized that, he was in Israel and he was at the Kotel, and he saw these Orthodox men with their tefillin, and they were davening. And
davening is the Yiddish word for praying.
Yes. See, I learned a few things, but he was seeing this, and I'm taking in the whole sight and realized, you know what? Jesus probably looked and sounded a whole lot more like them than he does like me.
Much, much correct. Yes.
Yeah. So that's, that's a big reason why this Torah awakening among Christians has been happening for the last couple of decades. Is a lot of people in a lot of different countries are coming to this same conclusion. And that, I believe, is opening the way for positive Jewish-Christian relations and reversing the trend of what we've seen in the last many centuries. Knowing that there's still a lot of hesitation and stereotypes and fears on both sides, well, that's why it takes what I call the supreme act of faith for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
To walk through it anyway, realizing we've got a whole lot more in common in our devotion to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob,
right,
and basically the Torah. I'll share something else. Last year, I saw a video with Rabbi Tovia Singer. I don't remember what was the occasion, but a gentleman was asking him something about right-wing influencers who were turning out to be anti-Semitic on social media. And one point he said was, you know, the Christians have taken the Torah to the world in a way that Jews couldn't. And I thought, oh my, Rabbi Singer and I have something that we agree on.
I was waiting to see where you're going to go with that.
Yeah. And another point that I mark out in my book, regarding the October 7th, it's more than a tragedy. It's a call to arms. It was massacres. You know, you lived through it. You're there in Israel. And, you know, I don't have to describe October 7th to Israelis and especially Jewish Israelis. But one of the stories, and I put this in the book as well, that got my attention was which communities Hamas and their allies attacked. And it wasn't the settlers in Judea and Samaria. No, these were the peaceniks, the ones who were at the forefront of trying to live in peace and harmony. You know, secular, Reformed Jews, you know, we probably were politically completely 180 degrees out. But it occurred to me, seeing they had borne the brunt of the Hamas assaults, even they, in their own way, with which politically I would profoundly disagree, they were living out this commandment to choose life.
Yes.
And their, by just their lifestyle, was one that lived out peace according to their understanding of it. So the fact that they were attacked, that should have been a wake-up call to the entire world that Israel, the Jewish people writ large, have always been at the forefront of trying to get along with one another. And that too, as we learn from Jesus in the New Testament, what's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind and all your strength. The second greatest, love your neighbor as yourself. So this has been it's been a foundational for me in understanding we do have so much in common.
Sure.
And there is good together that we can do for the entire world. So why are we still at odds? Excellent. And that's a big reason my buddy David Wilbur and I wanted to produce this book, is to help Christians understand that and understand that this war that you're currently fighting on, I don't know, 7, 8 fronts, it's our war too.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So that is a roundabout way of saying why I wrote this, but it was many years in the making, and especially since October 7th, 2023, that was the alarm bell, and I knew in time I need to write a book about it.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit israelthemiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
But did I understand correctly, Al, that it was only this past June that when you and David were sitting together that you actually started as they say, putting pen to paper. So this was a product of less than half a year. Physically the writing.
In a sense, there are several blog posts and other articles that I had written over the last, especially within the last 5 years, and particularly the last two or three, that found their way into my book.
Okay.
For instance, I think it's the third chapter where I talk about the land is promised to Israel.
Right.
In fact, I relate, well, actually half of that chapter was from a blog post that I wrote for 10 from the Nations, and it also appeared on my own blog, The
Got It
Fox. So, yeah, that was chapter 3, because God promised the land to Israel. And originally, the original article blog post was called West Bank of What?
Oh.
Yeah, and good. So there I'm making the case, the term West Bank was invented.
Yeah.
1950, when the Kingdom of Jordan illegally occupied and annexed Judea and Samaria after the War of Independence in 1949.
Right.
So that's how we
came. We have to do the spoiler alert, the full thing. So it's called the West Bank when Jordan occupied Judea and Samaria because.
Because it was on the western side of the Jordan River. And the Kingdom of Jordan is called that because the British said it's Transjordan on the other side of the river, the eastern side.
Correct.
So when the Emirate of Transjordan became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan in, that was 1946.
Right.
Well, they were part of the Arab coalition that attacked the infant Jewish state the instant that Ben-Gurion declared independence on May 14th, 1948. And at the end of that, well, Jordan's Arab Legion, I'm telling you the history, but others.
Okay, you're not telling me.
Okay. The Jordan's Arab Legion, along with the Arabs who were living there in Judea and Samaria, overran the region. They took East Jerusalem, removed the Jewish residents there, many of whom had been there for, centuries. And that's how Jerusalem became divided and how the land became divided into Israel proper, as the world knew it, and the West Bank, because no one knew what else to do with it.
And, is that not only did they physically occupy it, but they actually annexed it, making it illegally, making it part of Jordan, which, if I'm not mistaken, only two countries in the whole world recognized, Pakistan and the UK.
I believe that's correct, but that was an act of the Jordanian parliament declaring a union in 1950 between the eastern and the western banks of
Jordan.
Correct. Yeah.
Which underscores we could go on this historical part for all day, but it underscores a demographic reality that the Arab ethnic people, who now referred to as the Palestinians, were more or less the same on both banks of the Jordan River, which means that Jordan is majority ethnically Palestinian Arab, but the Hashemite kingdom, which was made up, was just because, as you said correctly, in the 20s, when the British decided they were going to give a little gift to Emir Abdullah from the Arabian Peninsula, they gave him a country that didn't previously exist in any map and called it. So I think I wrote it an article myself about it. It was probably the worst act of branding before New Coke back in the day, calling it Transjordan, which had absolutely no meaning.
Yes. Now, in my graduate studies and personal studies, a whole lot of that has focused on World War I and its aftermath.
Okay, good. Okay, that's where the seeds were.
Exactly. So, and I cover this in the book, too. The longest chapter is chapter 5, which is for the historical record. And by the way, little side note here, the reason it's the longest chapter is because I start with Abraham. What I see in both the Jewish and the Christian scriptures is the same precedent when you're making the case for Israel, when the prophets are talking to ancient Israel about come back to the ways of the Lord. And even in Acts chapter 7, when Stephen is called before the high court to give his defense, well, they all start with Abraham and tell the history of the nation as being called into covenant with the God of the universe, and how that is a continuity with where they were at that day. And I thought, well, it's a great biblical precedent. Why should I do any different? So we start with Abraham and we go all the way up to, well, now. So the opening or beginnings of the modern Zionist movement in the late 19th century are all part of that. And they get to World War I. And the reason the Middle East looks like it does now, but probably won't for much longer, is because the British Foreign Office and others, different aspects of the British government, they made deals with the Jews, Chaim Weizmann and the Zionist leaders in Great Britain. They made deals with the Arabs, the Sharif of Mecca and his sons, Faisal and Abdullah, because they needed their help fighting against the Ottoman Turks. They made deals with the French, because the French were their allies in World War I. They also made deals with the Russians before the revolution. So when the victors after World War I got to Paris in 1919 to sort everything out, well, to deconflict these conflicting agreements, the British and their partners, Arabs, Jews, French, Greeks and Turks, in fact, they came up with this that eventually became the map of the Middle East, the Mandate for Palestine.
Yes.
Yeah, the League of Nations awarded to Great Britain the Mandate for Palestine, which actually encompassed what is now Israel, Judea, Samaria, Gaza, Jordan. And then there was Iraq, which was created from three provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Iraq was never a unified state.
Correct. And they gave that to King Abdullah's brother, Faisal.
Actually, as I understand it, it went to Abdullah first.
But
Faisal was to be king of Syria.
However, but the French had other commitments.
Yes. Syria and Lebanon were under the French mandate.
Right.
And the French said, no, we'd rather not have to deal with Faisal. We would like to have our own government. So I believe it was 1922, the French enforced their point of view with their army.
Right.
And Faisal had to flee Damascus. And in compensation, the British said, why don't you go and become king in Baghdad? And so to compensate his brother Abdullah, they said, well, we don't know what to do with all this desert territory across the Jordan, so why don't you go to Amman and establish an emirate and become king of Transjordan? Mm. And that's how it happened.
Yeah.
So right away, up to 75% of the land of the British Mandate of Palestine, which is supposed to be a homeland for the Jewish people, well, that's given away, and we're left with all of that from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, to the river to the sea. And that's what the Arabs have been arguing over for 100 years now.
Which is why none of the Arab countries recognize Jordan's annexation of Judea and Samaria, because, first of all, it was illegitimate according to everything. Second of all, many of them had their own eyes on controlling this land. Part of it. Well, it would have been funny. This would be actually a really funny book to write if they had been successful in 1948 in pushing all the Jews to the sea. Who would have taken control, and what kind of a bloodbath would there have been among the Arabs? Because there was no indigenous ethnic Palestinian Arab group. They didn't have, they, there was never a country called Palestine. There was never an emirate or an anything called Palestine, except for the British mandate. And it would have been interesting to see who would have tried to control that and at spilling how much Arab blood to do so.
Yeah, but I think we have a picture of what that would be. Now you mentioned a few minutes ago that I had researched my book and
yes.
Okay. As one of my friends said, you let the heavy hitters do the talking for you. And he's right. So I refer to Mark Twain and Dennis Prager, David Friedman, Benjamin Netanyahu, people who have been in this fight for a long time, people who are well recognized. You know, Mark Twain was the guy who witnessed to the whole world in 1869 that the land of Palestine, as it was then called, named by the Romans, was empty.
Right, named by the Romans 100 years after Jesus died.
Exactly. You know, that after the second great Roman war against the Jews, revolt, and the Emperor Hadrian was so incensed that the Jews had revolted against him again that Judea was renamed Palestine.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when the diaspora began in earnest. Still Jews, this is another surprise to me along the way to learn that Jews have always been in the land, even when the Romans kicked them out.
Yes.
There was still a Jewish presence always, as, like in Hebron and Jerusalem, always there.
First of all, we were talking about I have the book in my hand. You're conveniently navigating through it. When people get it, they'll read it and be as immersed as I was, and as I am. But you talk about in chapter 5 and it being the longest chapter. But on page 77, you've got that great map of historical the British mandate for Palestine, and when you look at it, it just shows if you recognize that. I don't know, 80% of Jordan, maybe 90% of Jordan is desert. When you look at the straight lines that make up the borders of their nation, you realize that literally someone took a ruler and just drew the lines. It wasn't based on any geographic reality. It was just that this is where the line would be, and that they would have, the British would have a land bridge from the Mediterranean through what became the remainder of Palestine, the British mandate, through Jordan, through Iraq, that could go to then what was still an ally in Iran and potentially pumping oil or whatever they were doing at that time. So it's all very strategic.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible. Whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds. Just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
If I were to rip out chapter 5 from your book. It's the head of the the title of the chapter is Because of the Historic Record. And again, with the audience being Christian, to inform Christians about what they about why Christians should support Israel, would this be the most important chapter because this is perhaps the least understood?
You could make a case for that. Yeah, I would say so. Because what has been impressed on me so much, especially since October 7th, is that this war right now is the same war that Israel's been fighting since coming out of Egypt, dealing with the Amalekites who pounced on the stragglers and the weak. It's also, I would submit, the same conflict that has been happening ever since Ishmael taunted and threatened his half-brother, Isaac. And, you know, what I want to make the case for here is God created Israel when he called Abram and Sarah out of Ur of the Chaldees and say, go to this land I'm going to show you, and I'm going to make you a blessing to all the nations. He created this covenant nation of Israel to be his vehicle of redemption for all the nations. And, you know, there are spiritual powers that don't like that. And there are human beings who don't like that, because as we read in the first chapter of the Bible, well, our first ancestors made the decision to go their own way rather than follow the instructions of their creator. So ever since, we've been dealing with the consequences.
Yes.
Yeah. So these are the consequences. And God has continued to preserve Israel, often in spite of themselves.
Correct.
Because God himself says in so many places, I'm doing this for my name's sake.
Yeah.
And I would want Christian readers especially to see in this historical record, tying it all the way back to Abraham, this is the very same story. And then once you get that, that it's the same conflict, only the characters have different names today, then discern the spiritual elements involved. Then we can talk about the prophetic things and Christian expectations, Jewish expectations, but especially God coming through on his promises.
Right. So about 95% of what you just said would attract an amen from 90 or 95% of Christians, right? There are very few who would have any biblical dispute, historical dispute of what you just said, pulling out the modern, and not because it's not true, but because people don't necessarily know and they may be hearing it here for the first time. So what's the disconnect, Al? Why do you need to write a book like this if 95% of Christians of all denominations will say, yeah, what he said is true. Preach it.
because replacement theology and anti-Semitism is hardwired into us and has been for close to 20 centuries. It started with that break between the early church and Judaism as it was then, or as our friend David Nickretman says, Judaisms. And we could say Christianities, because there are nuances on all sides, which anyway, what happened second, third, fourth centuries with this hard break and division between the church and Israel, meaning the Jewish people and Judaism, it was a hard break because the church fathers said anything Jewish, celebrating the Shabbat, celebrating the Jewish festivals, all those things, we're not going to do it anymore. Not only that, are we not going to do it because Jews are cursed of God because they killed the Savior. We're going to do exactly the opposite. That's how we become blessed of God. Now, this is Al paraphrasing with my editorial license.
Well, we have a great rabbinic tradition in that, in paraphrasing and interpreting. So you're welcome.
Oh, Yeah, see, there you go. There are things that we have in common again. But we, you know, we even learned exegesis from the Jews. And especially now that I'm able to look into Jewish sources and find out what the sages say, I'm thinking, well, why did we have a problem with this? Yes, I can disagree with the Rambam. It's okay. Mm-hmm. But I can appreciate what he said 1,000 years ago out of his experience and understanding and study. So why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I study the Jewish sages and hear what they have to say about the scriptures, just like I study the Christian sages?
Yes.
So to answer your question, it really is an effort to overcome this predisposition to look on Jews as cut out from God's grace. And of course, there's the Jesus question. You know, if you don't accept Jesus, then obviously you're not going to come back into God's grace. And how can God have anything to do with this nation? That's what we're having to overcome. And we're not going to answer all the questions right now. We're not going to come to any satisfactory understanding right now, short of Messiah being here and explaining it to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I say the greatest act of faith that Jews and Christians together can have is set those differences aside. They're legitimate. We can't ignore them. Just to set them aside so we can concentrate on what we have in common, because we've each got a piece of this messianic kingdom preparation. And you can't do it alone. You need us. We don't really know what needs to be done, but we can encourage you and help you, and that's our job.
Well, so you just set me up for where I wanted to go, and you didn't even know where I wanted to go. So thank you. By the way, and one of the things I enjoyed about your book so much is that each chapter is in and of itself, the title of the chapter is an answer to the question. One chapter is because the Bible said so. One chapter is because God promised the land to Israel. The one we were just talking about, chapter 5, because of the historical record. I wanted to flip to chapter 8, which you just set me up for, because Christian support for Israel is prophesied. Now, I read it. I have a pretty strong understanding. But now, having got 95% of people listening to say amen and understand that, oh yeah, we believe this, but there is something that's also in our the DNA of our faith that is a little contradictory. Now you got, I think, probably more than 50% of the people scratching their head, wondering, where is Christian support for Israel prophesied? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, my favorite place to talk about that is in Zechariah chapter 8. In fact, that whole passage is the inspiration, first for the nations, ninth of Av, and now 10 from the nations, where the returning exiles from Babylon ask Zechariah, should we continue fasting now that we're back in the land and we're beginning to rebuild the temple? And he's talking about the fasts of the fourth month, the fifth month, the seventh month, the ninth month, 10th month, especially Tisha B'Av, that fast of the fifth month, which commemorates the both the Babylonian and the Roman destruction of the two temples. And what it says there in Zechariah 8:19, from 19 to 23, there's this whole dialogue where the word of the Lord through Zechariah is saying, if you continue to fast, but the fast of the fourth, fifth, seventh, and tenth months will become days of feasting and rejoicing,
right,
for the house of Judah, for the Jewish people. And the context that we're understanding is because these people from the nations are going to come around and encourage you and say, let us go up to Zion to seek the Lord. You know, I want to go with you, and we need to go together.
Right. Us is not us Gentiles or us Christians. Us is, in this case, Jews and Christians together.
Together. So Isaiah prophesies about, you know, kings and queens and the nations coming in to carry the people of Israel, carry their children, bringing them home. It talks about the wealth of the nations coming into Israel. And as I see it now, as over the 64 years I've been living on the earth, watching what has happened, it's not the Buddhists or the Hindus, and certainly not the Muslims, who are helping the Zionist dream, helping Jews to return, investing in Israel, providing support in every way. It's the Christians.
Right.
And Christians have been doing this all along, as I point out in the book. And by the way, David Friedman and Benjamin Netanyahu cover this extensively, of Christian friends of Israel, friends of Zion, and who's been involved, not just in the last 120 years, but stretching way back. Thinking especially of Theodor Herzl and Reverend Herschel, yes, the Anglican bishop.
Correct.
Who assisted him and was there as a non-voting observer at the first Zionist Congress in 1897. And he's the one who opened the way for Herzl to meet, the Kaiser of Germany,
right.
Many of the nobility and the movers and shakers of Europe back at the turn of the 20th century. Ord Wingate, who helped train the Jewish Legion and set the standards for the military excellence that the IDF has always been known for. And men like Winston Churchill and Harry Truman, and now we come down to the Trump administration, Donald Trump, our Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, our Secretary of State Marco Rubio, our soon-to-be ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. Now, I know Hegseth and Huckabee for sure are very strong Christians, and I'm pretty sure the others are too. But they are unapologetically Zionist.
Yes.
And, America hadn't had a king since 1776. But they're pretty up there in terms of sitting in the place of kings and princes.
Mm.
And it seems to me this would be part of that promise that Isaiah and the other prophets were saying from the mouth of the Lord, that the nations will come and bring you home.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
So it's not static. It's not that in chapter 8, it's not like historical reality and we say, okay, we agree with that historical reality as we agreed with that important chapter 5, but because this is actually living. This is something that exists and is meant to continue to exist.
Exactly. As a historian, this is something that I try to help people understand. We are very much a part of what has happened before with our ancestors. You know, we are what we are because of who they were.
Yeah.
And in terms of Israel and what God has promised for the restoration of his covenant people, the Jewish people, okay, that too applies. So when I talk about, you know, Harry Truman recognizing the state of Israel in May of 1948, and I talk about Donald Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the eternal capital, undivided capital of Israel in 2017, well, guess what? It's the same story.
Yeah.
Yes. And when we talk about those who, well, let's see, the Balfour Declaration, Lord Alfred Balfour, the foreign minister of Great Britain, for whom that declaration was named, well, he was a Christian Zionist.
Yes.
And he opened the way by the declaration for Jews to return in a big way with international sanction.
Right.
Right now, today, Dean Bai and Return Ministries, which he established, has been carrying on in that tradition in a very real way of helping Jews make Aliyah. And I mentioned some of those names as well. And to talk about Hayavel and the Waller family and the Hilton family, who for a quarter century now have been, in their humble way, helping Jewish farmers.
You know, it's amazing when you just said a quarter century, because that sounds like a lot more than 25 years, but quarter century is significant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, and it's a going enterprise. What I don't think I mentioned in this book, but one of my first trips to Israel, I became acquainted with Kibbutz Beth El and the history behind that.
Okay.
Two German families in 1962 who realized that Germany had been at grievous fault regarding the Jews during the Holocaust. So they came to Israel in a humble, just to humbly serve. And now it's a big international concern. Yeah. Corporation.
Yes.
Right. and people can come and volunteer. There's an industrial component which builds up Israel's economy. There's a senior facility to care for the elderly. And this humble beginning of two German families, two Christian German families, who wanted to make amends and serve the Jewish people and the Jewish state in any way they could, that has now gained the trust and respect of the Israeli government and people.
It's interesting, Al, because you're right. And I love going there. I love taking people there. They have a really fine bakery. And of course, everything's kosher, which I love. But, you know, earlier you mentioned something about Ward Wingate, and the Wingate Institute near Netanya is famous for so many things. And I probably wouldn't have thought of it, except for that my youngest son, who's in the army, recently spent a week at the Wingate Institute. And I'm sure that even my son, who grew up in a home whose father spends his waking days and even sleeping parts doing things on behalf of building relationships between Jews and Christians, most Israelis don't know who Ord Wingate was. Or other than he was a good British guy, which at the time we didn't have too many of here, but that he was motivated also by his faith. And these are important things for Israelis to understand, that the names of significant places here are living out that exact prophecy that you're talking about in chapter 8. That's pretty
cool. Exactly. By the way, let me recommend, as much as Christians and others outside Israel need to come and see Yad Vashem.
Yes.
I would recommend that Israelis go to the Friends of Zion Museum.
Agreed. No question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to give it away yet. I haven't shared it with you, but I've been having conversations. Actually, where you and I met in Charlotte, I don't know if you got to meet Tim, who's the publisher of Higher Life, who published our book, Israel the Miracle. He drove down from Raleigh because we're just friends now, and he wanted to come and celebrate the book, one of his favorite books. I think I'm not putting words in his mouth that they've published so far. And Tim and I are now talking about a different book that will have that should and will have significance to Jews and Christians as part of that inspiration, because Jews don't understand it. Your book is a primer for Christians to understand why, and then to follow what you and Bob O'Dell and the Wallers and everyone else who's listed and many who are not, in terms of how to live that out. But Jews, Israeli Jews, and Jews specifically, and Jews in general, do need to understand that. And as you can imagine, even if we've not spoken about it, I get no shortage of pushback from Jewish friends and others who I don't know, who will necessarily associate that anything that that people like you do has some sort of nefarious agenda based on almost, as you said, 20 centuries of history, much of which isn't so good. But we're in a new era, and that's why this is important. That's why your book is important and what you're doing. In the last couple of minutes, Al, I'm just curious. Having done one myself, it's a big deal to publish a book. Mm-hmm. And when you hit send on the final transcript, there's a moment of celebration, but there's a moment of, uh-oh, I hope nothing's wrong and I didn't leave anything out. I don't know if you had that, but I sure did. So now, 4 months after?
We published in January, yes.
Okay, so 4 months after hitting send, or when it came out, what's missing? What would you have added?
Oh, well, one thing I will add, and this is a thing you pointed out. I have a historical map in there called Palestine in the Time of Jesus.
Yes.
And I wanted to use that because it was first used as a Bible illustration in, I think, 1904. But to demonstrate that even Christians in our maps and our Bibles, we see the historical designation of the land as Judea and Samaria. And yeah, it was known as Palestine then. Well,
no, not in the time of Jesus. It wasn't.
Not in the time of Jesus, but in 1904 it was.
Oh, in 1904. Yeah.
In 1904. Right, right. So I appreciate you pointing that out. I would like to make that clarification.
Good.
In the next edition.
And anyone who's hearing this now should look in their Bibles, and if their Bible has a map that says Palestine in the time of Jesus, they can just cross out the heading, because that's one thing that's cool that Christians actually do. They take pens and highlighters and they mark up their Bibles. They need to scratch out that that title and just call it the land of Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So what I would add in the next edition, because events are happening, changing so rapidly, I'll just have to extend probably chapter 5, or maybe do an addendum of what's happened since December 2024, which was my writing cutoff for this book. I mean, back then, Israel was just beginning to send forces to secure Mount Hermon in the face of the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria.
Excellent historical point. Correct.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to need to bring it up to date. Other than that, I don't know. I really appreciate the people I've been able to enlist without their knowledge in helping my book just by quoting Dennis Prager and David Friedman and Benjamin Netanyahu and Mark Twain. May you rest in peace.
Yes.
And many others.
Excellent. Before we wrap up, Al, we could go on and unpack it, and for lack of time, and I always like to keep people wanting more, but B, I want people to read the book. I don't want this to be the audio version of it. I want people to actually get a copy. So two questions. First is, where can people get the book, Christian Zionism 101? And second question is, what have we not talked about that you want to just add for the record about your book or about the topic before people go and order theirs?
Okay, right now, best place is to go directly to Amazon.com and buy it there.
Okay.
if you go to our website, pronomianpublishing.com, that's my publisher, they'll just take you to the Amazon website.
No kidding. That's so interesting. Yes. All right.
Yeah, so we're working on other outlets, but for right now, just go to Amazon. Let's see. The next thing that we didn't cover that I've got all of 30 seconds to cover. the chapter on Western civilization being built on Judeo-Christian values.
Good.
Yeah. We share, and this is why Tovia Singer and I could have a point of agreement, although we disagree on so many things. No, the Torah is it. The Hebrew scriptures, that's where even we Christians understand the difference between right and wrong, because it's the same thing that God told to Moses and Moses told to the nation, the prophets expounded on it, and even Jesus and the apostles in the New Testament were drawing from that same foundational body of instructions for life.
Yeah.
So that's what our civilization is built on. And chapter 6, I expand on that. And so I guess that's the main thing that I would recommend people look at.
Okay. So friends, go get the book on Amazon, Christian Zionism 101, 10 Reasons Christians Should Support Israel and the Jewish People by Al McCarn. McCarn, and we'll put the link for that in the notes. And I, you know, Al, when we spoke in December, I was excited for you and to hear and looking forward to getting a copy. And I guess it was about a month or a month and a half later, I got a copy and I was able to, I have a stack of books you can't even see here on my desk. I don't get to go through books as quickly as I want to, but I was able to devour yours, and it's a good read. It's well documented, and it makes sense. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for making time today to share, and I hope that this will help broadcast your book, increase sales, and of course, then ultimately the message that you're aspiring to get out.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. It has been an honor and a pleasure.
Likewise. And relating to books, as we wrap up, as we've done for the last number of years, if you've been following Inspiration from Zion, at the end of every program, we make a special offer. It's called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. My bookshelf is overflowing. There are piles on my desk. I'm trying to find new places in my house to keep more books as I acquire them that I don't get to read all the time. And what we do every month is offer a special volume from Jonathan's Bookshelf. Now, for the last, oh, I would say 19 or 20 months, we've offered exclusively our book, Israel the Miracle. And all we ask that you do is follow and like Inspiration from Zion. And when you comment, share, or something else, that's all. Comment or share the link to the program that you're listening to now. We pick one person at random every month to receive a copy of the book, and it's a $75 value. It's really stunning, so I encourage you to get that as well and comment and share the link to this program. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. And if you're ever in the area, I encourage people to pop in and thank them for helping make this program possible. And special thanks as well to our friends, the Coyne family, for making their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to continue the dialogue and to build bridges. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or a special occasion or your favorite book, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your comments as well as part of a dialogue and invite you to send questions, especially questions you have about traditional Judaism, for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.